Members, we're going to officially start the State Government Finance Committee. Representative Hugh, will you move the minutes?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Pugh moves the minutes for February 26th. Members, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay, the minutes for February 26th are passed. In your packet, we're going to have first up on deck is Representative Kreisha's bill. And we're just in the process of tracking him down for this. I think perhaps before we do that, I think what we'll do, I don't want to start MMB, guys, and then have them stop. Perhaps, Representative, how you want to present his bill while he's coming.
His bill?
Mm-hmm. Familiar enough with it. This is the camp.
He wouldn't want me to butcher that for him.
Representative Kreisha, you're up on deck. Sorry to say your bill did not pass.
I knew
failure
it was going
to
be trouble.
On time.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Representative Howell, will you move House File 283?
I will move House File 283. To be in front of the committee, and is it?
It's going straight to the General Register.
Going to Gov Ops. And go to Gov Ops. Be referred to Government Operations. There you go.
Okay, Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. I apologize for the delay. I was actually checking on little ones to make sure they got to school in the snow. So. And if we had the Sentinel Landscape Bill, I'm sure it would have helped me. I just haven't figured out how, so I'll get to that. But this bill is actually one of the easier bills that I've carried in terms of what it's going to accomplish and the immediate effects that we can have very quickly just by a policy designation. So what we're doing here, and we have a Senate file as well, but I believe you have a map of Camp Ripley in front of you. In our area, Camp Ripley is one of our biggest economic drivers. Also shoots big guns and makes a lot of noise, and they have lots of military operations. So one of the things that we are trying to do is get a balance between those military operations and the expanding missions that are happening, as well as working with the surrounding homeowners and property owners. And we want to do this in a way that is very cordial. So there's an ACUP program out there, and my testifiers will talk about this a little bit more, that allows us to bring lands in for many different purposes. And one of those is to set those lands up, and with the Sentinel Landscape, we're going to do this with a designation as well, but to set those lands up so that they can be used for conservation and that they can still retain into the owners, but we're going to ask them not to develop on that land. It's totally voluntary, and inside this language we put in there, it's willful participation. But the idea is that we want landowners around the area to consider putting their land into this so that development, we don't see townhomes going up and we don't see the friction that can happen between housing developments as military operations are going on. So with that, I will turn it over to Jay Brzezinka, one of my testifiers, and I'll let him walk you through the bill.
Mr. Brzezinka, can you please announce your name and who you are with?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jay Brzezinka, and I'm with the Environmental Program at the Camp Ripley Military Training Site in central Minnesota. I do have a short presentation to provide to you that will provide some background regarding this bill. In America, there are over 420 major military installations across the country. Most of these were built 100 years ago, typically in isolated areas, away from large populations. Of course, the rapid pace of development and the economic engines that these military bases are leads to incompatible development, which in turn affects the missions and the operations of the military base. In 2013, three federal agencies announced a new initiative known as Sentinel Landscapes Partnership. The intent is to help reduce the adverse effects of incompatible development. These agencies include the Department of Defense, Department of Agriculture, and the Department of Interior. They are working together to protect military readiness, to preserve working lands such as agriculture and forest management, and to promote conservation on the landscape. Their goal is to focus on where these priorities overlap. Camp Ripley currently has a program called the Army Compatible Use Buffer Program, also known as ACUB. Over the last 10 years, we've been working with two partners to execute the program. They are the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources and the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. This program is a willing landowners program. For those landowners that are interested, there are two land protection measures, either fee acquisition or a conservation easement. 95% of the involved landowners are interested in conservation easements. The program was established in 2004 and is currently being funded primarily with Department of Defense funds, $23 million to date, along with Lassard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council funds, $4 million to date. The Camp Ripley ACUB program has been one of the most successful buffer programs in the nation, having completed 107 land transactions representing over 14,000 acres. The completed transactions are shown in red on the image. In addition, we have over 220 interested landowners representing 28,000 acres that are interested in participating in the program pending funding availability. This level of interest is an indicator of how effective the ACUB program has been. The interested landowners are shown in pink on your image. Camp Ripley is an amazing 53,000 acre facility that has prepared our soldiers for the battlefield for decades. In addition, Camp Ripley is the largest state-owned game refuge in Minnesota. It is one of the most culturally and ecologically rich environments in the Midwest, bordered by 18 miles of the most pristine shoreline along the Mississippi River. This Sentinel Landscape Initiative can be defined as preserving the working and rural character of our private lands, which is important for both national defense and conservation priorities. In Minnesota, working lands for agriculture and forestry and other natural lands provide many important public benefits, not to mention the importance of protecting the Mississippi River as a drinking water supply for St. Cloud, St. Paul, and Minneapolis. The recreational opportunities for hunting and fishing, habitats for species of greatest conservation need, shoreline protection of the Mississippi River, open space, commodity production, and maintaining the rural character of Minnesota is the focus of the legislation before you. This legislation will simply formalize a process that we used for years to enhance the effect of the ACUB program, and it will complement a national direction of the Department of Defense. Establishing Sentinel Landscapes in state law will provide a model for the nation, and it will allow us to more effectively compete for federal funding from agencies beyond just the Department of Defense. It will also better align federal and state programs that would support private landowners in a Sentinel Landscape. I'd now like to open up for questions or comments.
Members, any questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Kresha, maybe I'm confusing it with the ACUP program, but I think I've seen something like this before or in the last session. Has this been brought forward before, or is this, am I confusing with the ACUP program?
Representative,
I think I've heard about this before.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Nelson, for the question. This Sentinel Landscape is a new concept. And you have the ACUB program, which is the state-run. The Sentinel Landscape is really about trying to bring in Departments of Agriculture, DNR, the military, and going out to find national funds as well and tapping into federal dollars. So by getting this designation, this allows us to work among other agencies and to seek federal dollars. So if there has been other legislation, I'm not aware of it. This is the only one that I know of in this scope.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, the question I have in the bill, it says land, and I was curious what the status of a homestead might be, and then I have a follow-up question depending on the answer to that question.
Representative Kresha or Mr. Brzezinka.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Brzezinka.
No. Madam Chair, members of the committee, regarding a homestead, as an example, if a landowner has 80 acres and they want to participate in the program and they want to do a conservation easement, we'd put an easement on, let's say, 75 acres, and they would not put the homestead within the easement. So any developable area would be out of the easement.
Representative
okay.
Carlson?
Madam Chair, that, I think, answers my question. I have an airport in my district, and they created a buffer around, and there were some issues when homeowners had damage to the home above a certain percentage, or maybe wanted to build a garage or expand a garage or add a room on their house, and there were some issues that surfaced. But you're saying that with that 5-acre exemption, then that if a person had a homestead within the area and they wanted to improve their home, expand the home, build an outbuilding or whatever, they would be able to do that.
Right. Representative
Okay, Grisha. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And is there a definition then of sentinel landscape? What is that?
Mr. Brzezinka?
To the test cards, I guess.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yeah, the intent is there's a federal initiative that talks about the sentinel landscapes of several partners getting together, Department of Defense, the Ag, and the Interior. In other words, the Ag has a mission across the nation, right, to protect Ag. Department of Interior has a mission to protect such things as forestry, and of course the military has a mission to protect military bases. Well, that overlaps. As an example, Camp Ripley, the southern third of the off-post lands around Camp Ripley are agriculture. So in other words, there's an ag mission to not only protect ag, but if they protect that ag, it'll also protect the mission. So the Sentinel Landscapes concept looks at bringing all three agencies together, partnering where these priorities overlap, and trying to protect not only a military mission, but ag and conservation and forestry and those type of things.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So notion, is that a federal notion then, primarily, is that what you're saying?
That's correct. Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. There's an initiative in 2013 called Sentinel Landscapes by the three federal agencies. We're trying to showcase that here in Minnesota with state agencies now to partner with the same similar state agencies.
And Madam Chair, question on land management activities within that landscape. Will the committee that's reviewing those management activities, will that include some public use opportunities, or is that what they're going to look at, as such as trails and biking and whatever? So I know it's a beautiful landscape up there. Is it thinking that there'll be some opportunities to take advantage of it?
Mr. Brzezinka.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, actually there's a Camp Ripley Veteran State Trail that are trying to make a connection from, the Paul Bunyan Trail comes all right. The way to St. Crowing Park, and there's also trails at the Sioux Line Trail at Lee's Little Falls. Actually, there's an initiative by the state already to make that connection. Actually, once that's connected, that'll be the largest paved bike trail in the world. But also all the other surrounding lands. One of the initiatives that one of our partners, the Department of Natural Resources, has already created a wildlife management area within the buffer program. Actually, there was interested landowners that wanted to actually sell in fee, and then we started to buffer those lands. So actually we created opportunities for hunting and fishing through this wildlife management area initiative, and also now we're buffering that same investment of protecting that land. So yes, there are plenty of opportunities for recreational.
Very good. And thank you, Madam Chair. That's tying into the Mississippi River.
Representative Johnson, I think Representative Grisha had a comment to that.
I just want to follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things that I want to make sure we're abundantly clear on this is it's a willful participation of the private landowners, so they still retain those private rights in exchange for not developing in some areas. But while we'll try to expand some public hunting and fishing and all that, we still have to respect their private lands. Now, the trade-off, of course, and he mentioned the Camp Ripley Trail, is Camp Ripley has offered up some of their area for this trail. So what this really is a cooperation, but I want to make sure, because the landowners would ask this, is that we're also respecting their private. I mean, we're not going to just let people come in and hunt in their back door either without them getting the permission or working with all the programs. So I just clarification. So great question.
Yep. Sure. Representative Johnson?
That trail I'm referring to, is that the Mississippi River Trail, the bike trail, the longest trail that goes from Lake Itasca down to New Orleans?
Madam Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's the Paul Bunyan Trail comes to the Crowing State Park, and then there's a Sioux Line Trail that leaves, and a Wobegon Trail that leaves also in different directions south of us. The missing gap is this Camp Ripley Veteran State Trail. It's been designated as a state trail. It just hasn't been developed yet. So it's in the process, it's in the planning phases, and it's also in the process of putting that segment together. Once that segment is together, it will be the longest paved trail in the world.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a few questions, perhaps of the author. Were landowners in this area consulted? Did they have a choice if they were at the edge to be in or out? Is there a valuation impact to them on their property valuation? Is there a tax impact to the county? And then what financial incentives are you anticipating to encourage people to be part of this?
Representative Grisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Runbeck. Great set of questions. So I'm going to actually, we actually have a waiting list, I believe, at this point. But I'm going to let Mr. Brzezinka handle some of that, and I'll make sure I circle back because he's much more familiar with that.
Mr. Brzezinka.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, representative. Yes, the landowner is paid an incentive. If they do a conservation easement, actually the Department of Revenue estimates the value of an upland ag acre by township. As an example, in there's 9 townships around Camp Ripley. The value of an upland ag acre in a certain township might be worth $2,000. With the ACUB program, we're currently paying half that. So the landowner to get up to, as an example, $1,000 per acre of land that they put into the easement. They're still the landowner. They still can farm it. They still can recreate it. They can still grow trees on it. They still pay taxes on it. So the incentive is the easement. They get paid for the easement, but it still stays on the tax rolls. Those type of things. If the land is purchased through fee acquisition, our partner, the Department of Natural Resources, does that fee acquisition, and then there's a PILT payment to the county, payment in lieu of taxes for that fee acquisition parcel.
Representative Rumbach.
Madam Chair, and sir, is it a permanent easement then, so that a future landowner, or is there an opportunity to sell the land to another landowner or not?
Mr. Brzezinka.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, there is a perpetual easement, and the landowner is able to sell the land, yes.
All right, thank you.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my question goes to the scope of the program in terms of is it the desire to protect the landowners from the activities that the military carries out at Camp Ripley on the periphery, or is it the longer-term perspective that your intention is to expand the footprint of Camp Ripley, and this would be an opportunity to have undeveloped land in a more conducive setting for acquisition as opposed to a demolition and then acquisition?
Mr. Brzezinka.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. The intent is not to expand Camp Ripley at all. There's no acquisition. We have two partners that execute the program, Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources and Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. So they become the easement holders or the land holders. The Department of Military Affairs, I work for, or the Minnesota National Guard, doesn't acquire any of the land. So it's done through our partnerships. And the state of Minnesota then holds title, both the title to the land and also to the easement. The intent is not to expand the base. The intent is to work with willing landowners to prevent our noise and dust and smells and those type of things. And the gentleman mentioned earlier about the airport. Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport was built 40 miles away from the metro 50 years ago because they knew that activity would cause disturbance and noise. But you can see how that airport got encroached upon. That's what's happening to military bases across the country. They are eventually getting encroached upon. So this is the intent to work with willing landowners. So it's a willing landowner program. If they're willing to work with you, put easements on the lands through, or some want to sell through fee acquisition, it's an opportunity for us to help lessen the impact that we have on society, or at least on the general public. And you can tell by the map with the pink, and again, those are interested landowners. There's 28,000 acres of interest out there. So, and we didn't really go out and solicit the interest. There's a lot of landowners in central Minnesota really want to maintain the rural character of Minnesota. They still want to farm. They still want to hunt and recreate. They themselves don't want development in and around their parcels or even around the area. So it's very beneficial. We still have a time because the area hasn't been developed yet. We can still maintain our mission current and into the future, and the willing landowners are willing to participate in that.
Okay. Representative Cretia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to compliment that, and Representative Albright, thank you for the question. There's a very unique situation up here with Camp Ripley. And we have these landowners who, and the flip side of this, they want to retain these acres, they want to hold on to those, and they want to pass them through family. But what we're finding is, actually, with some of the school boards coming up, the bondings that are coming, it's getting very expensive to hold on to this land. In fact, a lot of them, they may have 80 acres or 160 acres that they hunt on, and suddenly it's becoming very hard for them to hold on to the land. Programs like this are allowing them to keep their land into the families. And I've heard from many, many landowners that say this was one of the better things to help them because the tax is still going to the county. We're not losing that. It's not like some of the horror stories of land acquisition that you hear where we grab the land, take it off the tax rolls. This is actually the opposite. And more importantly, we're working with Camp Ripley. And what we've heard from Camp Ripley is that because of the way the nature is going, the military is going in the future, they're not going to lessen their activities. So all they're asking landowners is, if you participate in this, we'll get you some incentives to not develop and to make this a very cordial relationship, and it's been working very, very well. So that's why I brought it in front of you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I've got a question of either you or Ms. Roberts. We have two fiscal notes in our packets. One is dated 2/16/15, the other is 2/18. The 2/16 fiscal note, and we're not talking large sums here, but show $4,000 in 15 and then $27,000 for the next biennium. And then the second fiscal note shows no fiscal cost. And there was no description. It says this is page 1 of 15. There wasn't an amendment to the bill, so I'm just kind of curious what transpired there, where it went from a modest cost of, I'll just use the biennial number, $27,000 to zero, but yet no change in the bill. And then in both fiscal notes, they still show under the equivalent positions or the FTE a 0.1. So that didn't change. So I assume then that they are going to take that out of current complement or something. But what transpired, Madam Chair or Ms. Roberts, that we, with no change in the bill, go from a modest cost to no cost?
Ms. Roberts.
Madam Chair and members, when the original fiscal note that's dated February 16th was first released and I saw it, I immediately had a question about why there were being costs shown for agencies that were already participating in this process. And so I contacted both the MMB staff and Mr. Kerr at Department of Military Affairs, and we had a discussion about this. And there was agreement that because this was a process that was already in place and staff were already doing this work, that this was a situation where it was appropriate for the agencies to show that those costs would be absorbed. And so the fiscal note was revised.
Okay, Madam Chair, that explains it then. Thank you.
And Representative Carlson, the reason why we put both of those copies in your folder is because this will be part of a larger conversation after we're done with Representative Kreisch's bill. So just to kind of give you a flavor for that. I have Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Kreisch, or either the testifiers, I guess the question I have is, and a couple questions I have here in my mind. One is, this is going to be a perpetual easement now, and it kind of goes to what Representative Rundeck was asking earlier. In future, if this land gets sold in the future, now the payment you're talking about, you gave the example of $1,000 per acre, is that going to be ongoing every year, or is that a one-time payment to the current landowner? So 10 years from now, the landowner sells his property, the new landowner comes, there's this easement on, but he's not getting any benefit of payment for that if it's a one-time payment. And I guess the question I have kind of leads into the whole debate we've had here around in the past about green acres and how that changed back and forth and people misunderstanding it. And I just want to make sure we're not setting up another issue where 10 years from now we're going to have a bunch of landowners coming back screaming that they didn't get, you know, that we took their land or took their value from their land. So I guess that's where my whole questions are in my mind are around.
Representative Kreisch.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Nelson. That's a great question. I'm going to, Mr. Brzezinka has been far more active in this as well. So, if you
Mr. Brzezinka.
Madam Chair, members of the community, Representative Nelson. Yes, it is a perpetual easement. It stays with the land, not the landowner. It is a one-time payment. So, yes, the landowner will get a one-time payment. And every parcel of land has a package of rights. You have access rights, development rights. You have a suite of different rights. And we're paying for that one development rights as part of this easement concept. So, yes, they are paid for it. It's a one-time payment, and it is perpetual.
Representative Nelson, any follow-up?
So, Madam Chair, I guess in my mind it would then, at some time in the future, because there are no longer development rights on there, it could affect the future value of this land, and we're paying the current landowner for that. I guess that's the concern I have is, I mean, the ACUP program I support, like I said, I think I've seen this before, and it's probably the definition of talking about the ACUP program in past years, but
it's a good program, and I agree with the principles of it. I mean, too often, as the suburbs and as housing expands out into farmland or currently undeveloped land, you have the new people coming in, you know, the farmer that's been there 100 years, they don't like the smell of that farm. You know, I can see that here with the military base, that loud guns being shot that I didn't expect that way, you know, and try and get that changed when they are the newcomers to the area. So I mean, I can understand that tension that's there. So it's just a concern I have of, you know, the future landowner, somebody sells their property, if the future lander comes and says, I didn't agree to this, and even though the easement's on there, causing problems in the future, and that's my concern.
Mr. Bozinko, when one of the property owners sells their property, and do they have to give notice that this easement exists?
Madam Chair, members, yes, it's on the title, so yes, that easement exists. But with a lot of landowners, as an example, majority of them are agriculture. The current land use is ag. It never was for developable. So even though we're buying development rights as part of the process so they can't put homes on it, they can still farm it and use it for the intended purpose. So that's why we have such a suite of interested landowners, 28,000 acres of interested landowners, because they realize that this is a pretty great program. They can still farm. They can get paid to maintain their current land use on, which is typically ag or forested or recreational type. So that's why we see such an interest. There isn't a lot of development around camp. Most of the current residents don't want to develop it. A lot of the older landowners don't necessarily want to split it and give it to the kids. They want to maintain it as a piece. A lot of them want to get into this program so they can pass it on as a larger chunk of land to the next generation. So it's that's why it's been very supportive in the local community.
Okay. Any other questions, members? Any comments from the public? If not, Representative Howe renews his motion to send this to GovOps. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay, Representative Kreisha, House File 283 goes to GovOps next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Okay. Folks, we have representatives from MMB here to present on their enterprise systems. They could come to the table, please. Good morning and welcome. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Michelle Weber. I'm the Enterprise Resource and Planning Director at Minnesota Management and Budget, and I'm here to provide you an overview of the enterprise technical systems used at MMB on behalf of the state. Micah Intermel is with me and is here also to provide follow-up to some of the questions that the committee raised last time we were here.
Excellent. Ms. Weber, if you can proceed, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, information is being distributed to you right now, and that's what I'll be speaking from. And I was wondering, as an offset to the distraction, if we could potentially turn this off. Thank you. Madam Chair and members, on page one of the presentation materials that are being distributed to you, it provides an overview of the statewide systems that we indicate are enterprise-wide systems. There are 8 systems in total. Each of them are integrated, and in some cases, many of them share data and information across the systems, or they may be operating from the same technical platform. The rest of the presentation will focus on an overview of each of the systems individually. So starting with the budget systems, there are 3 systems that comprise the budget systems: the budget planning and analysis system, the fiscal note tracking system, and the capital budget system. On page 2, I provide an overview of the budget planning and analysis system. Each of the budget systems are either in the process of being replaced or have recently been replaced. The purpose of the budget planning and analysis system is to provide an overview of the biennial operating budget. It collects information for the base budget, the governor's budget recommendations to the legislature, as well as information related to the enacted budget. This system is used to publish the biennial budget books that you've all received earlier this year, as well as the consolidated fund statement. We have 250 licensed users for this system that are in various state agencies, both large cabinet agencies as well as small agencies and boards. The University of Minnesota, MinSCU, the courts enter information into the system, constitutional offices, and legislative fiscal analysts utilize information that's contained in the system. The technology that the system has been developed in is an off-the-shelf product from Oracle called Hyperion Planning and Budgeting for the Public Sector. We are operating in version 11.1.23, which is not the most recent version of this technology that's available.
Why is that?
The most recent version just recently was released.
Okay.
So we are looking at the possibility, Madam Chair, of upgrading over the summer to the most recent version.
And Ms. Weber, when you say it's off the shelf, is this something that other states have used, or what do you mean by that? Can you help me out?
Madam Chair, that's correct. What it is it's a custom off-the-shelf product that is designed to provide certain functionality for collecting budget information and reporting budget information. There are other states that have implemented this particular software as well, and there are other bodies of government, so there are local units of government. In Minnesota, we also have Ramsey County that has utilized the software, as well as some school districts in the state.
Okay. Ms. Weber?
The costs for developing the system for Phase 1 were $2.2 million. The funding for that was from MMB operating dollars to support the first phase. And in 2013, the legislature appropriated additional dollars for the budget systems comprehensively, all three of the budget systems that I mentioned. And of that appropriation, there was a total of $4.5 million appropriated, and 2.1 of that was dedicated to work related to the BPAS system. And that was intended to support both Phase 1 improvements as well as Phase 2 and Phase 3 development. So this system went live in August of 2012. It first supported the submission of the 2014-15 biennial budget to the legislature. Over the last year, 2 years, the MMB has been working in partnership with MINIT on improvements related to user experience. We did a survey of users after the first year implementation and conducted some focus groups. So we redesigned the entire application. We did upgrade to the most recent version that we are operating on. When we went live with the system, it was on an older version of the software. And we also had to rebuild our production environment. For Phase 2, we used the system to publish information for last year's supplemental budget recommendations from the governor and summary information related to the last legislative session enacted budget. For Phase 3, that work is still under development, and we are hoping to utilize the system in the future to produce the departmental earnings report that is produced as part of the governor's budget recommendations to the legislature, to allow agencies to directly enter into the system changes to their budget structure, and to publish more detailed information related to the enacted budget. So all of those elements are currently in the design phase.
And Ms. Weber, just to walk through the numbers again, so that you initially used $2.2 million was from the operating budget from MMB, and then you got a $4.5 million allocation from the 2013 session, and 2.1 of that went towards the BPAS.
Correct, Madam Chair. The remainder of that appropriation was used for the fiscal note tracking system and replacement of the capital budget system. So we'll see numbers as we move forward in the presentation related to those.
Perfect. All right. Go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, some of the successes are that this is now a web-based system. It also allows for users to log in through a single sign-on, so users who utilize many of the statewide systems have the same login, the same password that they are using. We've improved the user interface, meaning we have improved the forms that people enter and see information directly in the system. We've also redesigned the biennial budget book significantly from what was done in the 2014-15 biennial budget process. Some of the challenges that we faced with this is that the reporting tool that comes with the off-the-shelf product is significantly limited in terms of the amount of information that we collect related to the biennial budget. In particular, we struggle greatly with combining textual information that we collect on governor's change items and data associated with those change items. So we've had significant limitations related to reporting. We've also had some system performance issues. The larger the system becomes, the more data we're collecting in it, the greater amount of time it takes for certain processes to run. Also, meeting the multitude of activities that occur with the governor's biennial budget. So there's the collection of base budget information. There's also the decision support process that is used by the governor as the governor is considering which items to produce. And the ways in which information is presented is often changing during that course of time, and some of the reporting challenges have made that difficult. In addition, the budget book document that's produced from the system, the PDF document, does not comply with current accessibility standards. And we've been working with Oracle on the potential of improving that in the future. So right now we have documents that are available to be printed so that individuals can see the entirety of an agency's budget book that are not able to be fully accessible as they're posted to the web.
I'm going to pause you there, Ms. Weber. We have a couple members that have some questions. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, first of all, I want to thank you. Representative Holberg and I were briefed by you upon occasion, and we had an opportunity for some input, so I appreciate that. But one thing that I either never thought about or I missed was in your introductory comments, you mentioned licensure for individuals. And Ms. Weber, if you could explain exactly what that means, and is that individuals, a system? What came to mind was when you mentioned Minsku in particular, where virtually every campus has a financial officer. So I don't know if you mean you license the system or each individual within the system or a department in state government is licensed, and what does that constitute?
Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair and Representative Carlson, for many of our systems, the state has purchased a certain number of licenses when we purchase the software. And then what we traditionally do is identify individuals within agencies that perform the business functions related to that system. So in the case of the BPAS system, the Budget Planning Analysis System, we've purchased a certain number of licenses, and then each agency has a certain number of individuals, but they're not, we haven't allocated a specific number of licenses to a specific entity. It's based on what the entity has conveyed to us their business need is.
Representative Carlson?
Well, I think that, Madam Chair, I think that answers it. So, for example, in the Minsku system, then the system would be licensed, and then they would share with you who their financial people are throughout the system.
Ms. Weber?
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, that's correct. MMB holds the licenses for each system, and then we grant users access to it based on the licenses we've purchased.
Yep. Thank you.
Okay. And Ms. Weber, on the do you charge back then to the agencies for the licenses or no, Ms. Weber?
Madam Chair, we do not for the budget planning and analysis system. For some of our other systems, we have a mechanism called statewide billing, statewide systems billing, and so some elements of supporting the statewide systems overall, including licensure, are incorporated in what agencies pay through that mechanism.
And Ms. Weber, too, have you done some training then for the different agencies to get them up to speed on how to use the program, or?
Madam Chair, yes, we have. We conducted significant training efforts in July and August of this year and have developed some web-based training also. That's available on the web.
Okay. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm learning a great deal here, but I guess I've got a couple of questions. One is, and I think you're just going to confirm this for me because as I'm reading in here, it's an off-the-shelf product that you needed to modify to meet your needs. So who did you have to hire outside consultant, or is everything being done by Minute to modify it to what our needs are?
Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair and Representative.
I don't want to wish that on anyone.
In the case of the budget planning and analysis system, which is pretty consistent with many of our statewide systems, it's a complement of both. So when we first implemented the budget planning and analysis system, we did engage in a contract with a consultant, with Oracle, to help us implement that system the first year. And then since that time, we've done further development, mostly in partnership with Minute staff. And in some cases, Minute will also do what's called staff augmentation, where rather than contracting with a specific vendor, they'll contract more with a supplementary individual who will act as though they are a staff person.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then I heard you say something about having problems with our base budget system. As we develop this for our base budget system, is there other budget systems where this would be easier to use for, or will it be adaptable if we change to a different budget system, such as a zero-based budget or something to that effect? Having gone through that pain myself, going from a base to a zero base, it was a very difficult time the first time, but afterwards it was very easy to do. So I'm just wondering, as we develop this budgeting process for the base budget, will it be easily adaptable to different budget systems if we choose to do that?
Ms. Weber?
Madam Chair and Representative Howe, the system is developed based on the current statutory requirements for submission of budget information, and so it currently collects the base that which is established based on the last year of the biennium's appropriation, and then agencies enter in change requests. If we were to transition to a different type of budgeting process, so if we were to transition to a zero-based budgeting process, depending on the nature of that, it would require system changes. How significant those changes would be dependent on what's being considered.
Representative Howe.
I think, Madam Chair. So, but it is adaptable. So it is a system that we could change to do whatever budget system that we need to.
Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair and Representative Howe, it is adaptable. However, with an off-the-shelf product, it has certain limitations. So as I indicated, it would be totally dependent on what it is. If you still are collecting information in the same manner traditionally information has been collected, and are you collecting additional information beyond that, those are the types of things that might require additional programming, additional functionality, additional collection of data in the system.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you were speaking of challenges, you mentioned reporting limitations and said textual and data. I didn't understand what you were talking about. Could you explain a little bit of what you mean?
Ms. Weber?
Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, a concrete example of that would be as the governor submits changes for consideration by the legislature, descriptive types of information are collected for that. Traditionally, they have been known as the change pages. So it provides an overview of what an agency, what funding they're requesting, what's the impact that's going to be achieved if that funding is received. And then in the system, in addition to textual information, we collect numbers. What is the dollar impact associated with the change? Bringing those two pieces, that descriptive and the dollar impact, together into one report has been very challenging in this off-the-shelf product.
And Ms. Weber, to that point, I mean, we've experienced some of that in going through the budget book. We have the governor's recommendations in there, and some of the numbers don't quite jive, and so that's been kind of challenging to kind of figure that out. Do you have a timeline of is that part of the improvements portion that you're going to be doing, or phase three, or when do you think you'll kind of have that solved? Because it makes it challenging for us as we're going through the budget books to truly understand where the finances are. So,
Madam Chair and members, we are starting discussions on that this week. We are concerned that we may not be able to do that in the reporting tool that's available in the system, and we might need to look at developing something in addition to the current reporting tool to be able to do that more systematically in the future. But we don't have a specific timeline. We're just beginning the discussions about what the possibilities are right now.
Well, and just so you know, so a lot of times I'll see something that just doesn't make sense, and I go to Ms. Roberts. So if you can be in communication with her, and maybe it'll give you a better insight of what we're seeing and how that's causing problems and understanding the numbers. I think that would be helpful if you would. Representative Johnson, did you have any other follow-up at all? Okay, Ms. Weber?
Madam Chair, members, moving on now to page 3, which is an overview of the capital budget system. This is another system that is supported by the $4.5 million appropriation that was received in 2013. This system is currently under development. It is scheduled to go live in May of this year. This system will be used to collect both from state agencies as institutions of higher education and local units of government capital budget requests, which get submitted to the legislature in July, and the governor's capital budget recommendations, which will be made to the legislature next session, as well as track information by the capital budget coordinator at MMB about the House and Senate positions with respect to the capital budget and ultimately produce enacted capital budget information. This system will have 200 users. It is being developed through a custom .NET technology, so it's a custom development in partnership with Minute, and they have brought on consultants to help with the build of this system. Of the $4.5 million, $1.4 million was allocated for the development of this system. It is being developed through a phased-in approach. So the first phase, which will go live in May of this year, will be the ability for state agencies, institutions of higher ed, and local units of government to input their capital budget requests into the system. Over the summer, we'll be working on the capacity to provide the legislature with the governor's recommendations related to the capital budget, and then the final phase of that will be the ability to track the House and Senate positions and ultimately publish information related to the enacted budget. The new things that will be available in the system that weren't available in our legacy system are the ability for local units of government to apply directly through the technical system. Also, additional functionality that does support all of the aspects of the capital budget development. The challenges that we've had is we've had some key staff turnovers. Our capital budget coordinator recently left the agency for a different position. And we also last fall determined that initially we were looking to develop this system in the same system that the operating budget, the BPAS system, is developed in. And due to the limitations with the ability to bring together text and descriptive information and the numbers, the capital budget has a great deal of textual information included in that. We decided that it would be more appropriate for us to do a custom build than use an off-the-shelf product. Using even a custom build, collecting descriptive information directly in a technical system that allows for things like boldface and italicized words and bulleted information and tables, we've had some challenges with that. It's called rich text. And so we're introducing complementary technical solutions to be able to provide that capacity in the system. Also, local units of government applying directly in a technical system will be a new element, and there are firewalls and security measures that are put in place, and so we have learned what it will take to give full access to the local units of government, and we know what that is, but that will take some effort to get that set up so that local units of government are able to apply directly in the system.
Okay. I'm going to pause you another moment here. I've got Representative Nash.
Madam Chair, thank you. Ms. Weber, I wanted to go back to the Hyperion platform. So knowing Oracle as I do, I had a couple of questions that jumped out at me. Is there an ongoing support contract that you've got in place with them that's separate than the acquisition price?
Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair and Representative, there is. Okay. Yes, we currently have an ongoing support and maintenance agreement with them.
Okay.
Separate from, there were two transactions that occurred with Oracle. The first was the purchase of the software and the licenses, and then the other was a professional technical contract, consulting contract for them to help us with the build of the application. And the ongoing annual agreement is for ongoing support and maintenance of the system. And that agreement allows us things like to get upgrades of the technology, to have those available, and to also enter service requests with Oracle if we have a system bug or something that's not working correctly.
Representative Nash.
Madam Chair, a couple of follow-ups regarding that. The cost for the maintenance contract versus the internal costing you're getting from Minute, I was wondering if you could provide us a comparison of that. Because again, knowing Oracle as I do, they own the software. They are far more intimately acquainted with it. I would imagine that the learning curve associated with Minute is going to be much more steep for them than having Oracle provide that for you.
Ms. Weber?
Madam Chair and Representative, I don't have that breakdown with me currently, but we can look into that, the differences there.
I would appreciate that.
Representative Nash?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The other overarching question that I have is it operating as deployed for the .23 release? Because I've just noticed, and I am new here, but we seem to get fiscal notes rather late in the game, and I'm just wondering is that a function of the software not being able to generate those reports in a timely manner, or is there some other mitigating factor that's creating that?
Ms. Weber?
Madam Chair and Representative, the fiscal note tracking system is developed in a different software than the Oracle Hyperion, which is used for the biennial budget purpose. The fiscal note tracking system is developed in a custom build.net program. The delays in fiscal notes are not system related. Any delays that you may be experiencing are in terms of putting together the content of the fiscal notes, the work that's associated with that.
Or Ms. Weber, you're going to get into that in greater detail in a little bit, I assume, on your...
Madam Chair, I will be providing an overview of that system.
Madam Chair, last follow-up. The .24 release, is that what you're going to, or are you going to be skipping a release? Are you looking at the 2.4, or what's the next release?
Madam Chair and Representative, 2.4 is the most recent release. We just yesterday started to look at the technical specifications related to that. Our plan is to install it in one of our development environments this summer and take a look at to see what types of functionality it provides, as well as some of the things we've experienced when new versions have come out. There have been changes to the user interface, so we do an assessment of are the changes significant and do we want to continue on the older version. One of the new things that is available is compatibility with more recent Internet Explorer browsers, so we are interested in considering it for that case.
Representative Nash?
Madam Chair, and last follow-up, the 2.4 release, what's the fee associated with that, and you're going to migrate that to a dev machine? Is Minute doing that? Are you doing that? Is Oracle going to be in partnership with you on-site to provide some support?
Ms. Weber?
Madam Chair, Representative, the functionality of that will be conducted by Minute staff that are dedicated to support the budget system. Oracle is available to us. We have call-in support. They have provided us with on-site consultation in cases where we're experiencing significant challenges.
Representative?
Madam Chair, I appreciate it. I never heard the cost for the 2.4 release.
Ms. Weber?
Madam Chair and Representative, there is not an additional cost associated with that. That is part of our annual support and maintenance that we pay.
Okay. Representative Howe?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And what I'm trying to identify here is you created the need, or you identified the need, what you wanted out of the capital budget system. And I understand it's a net custom build that's being done by Minute. Are there other states that already have this capability? Did we consult any of those states that have got this capability already? And could we have purchased that capability from them instead of developing this thing from the ground up? I guess I'm a little concerned that we're recreating the wheel on something that maybe some other state out there has already have, instead of recreating this from the ground up in our state.
Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair and Representative, we are members of the National Association of State Budget Officers, and so regularly are in communication with other state agencies and have participated in conferences where we discuss the technical systems that support the different budget processes. Minnesota is a bit more advanced in terms of technology for the capital budget system than some of the other states that are out there. But we are in communication with other states to determine what types of solutions are they doing. Are they doing custom build? Are they considering off-the-shelf products? Things of that nature.
Madam Chair.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just struggle with this when we have these challenges are we trying to stretch a little bit too far sometimes? I mean, is there some of these things we can say, you know what, we can't get there right now, the technology's not right where we want to be, and we just decide that that's probably not where we need to go at this time, or I guess, you know, sometimes when we set that goal, maybe we got to go someplace else to get there first. I'm a little concerned that we got this idea that this is where we want to be. No other state's gone there before, and we're doing this little Star Trek deal, and I'm a little bit concerned with that.
Ms. Weber?
Madam Chair and Representative Howe, in the case of the capital budget system, we did have a legacy system that already existed, and our intention with that was to replace that system and add some additional functionality onto it. And so we have reached out to other states to determine if they have functionality that exists within their systems, or and in the case of the capital budget system, we actually, in the change in direction from what software platform we utilized, we did recognize that we were trying to accomplish more than was feasible within the off-the-shelf product, and that's what caused the change in direction.
And Ms. Weber, when you say you had the collaboration of the different state boards, who does that include? Is that more of a regional or is that nationwide? Can you give us a better idea of who that includes?
Madam Chair, that is a nationwide organization. It represents all of the states.
Okay.
And its budget directors who are members of that, state budget directors.
Okay. All right. Representative Carlson.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I want to go back to your comment where you said you expand use to include local units of government for the capital request. And could you just kind of quickly walk me through, the committee through, just how that would work? What comes to my mind is that probably everybody around the table at some time or other has met with our local units of government, and they will express a need, and we will work with them and then introduce legislation. So what will be different then from what typically happens now relative to the local units of government? And the other point, I spent many years, probably about 30 years, on the Capital Investment Committee, or, well, even before that, when we did all of that through appropriations. And you do have, I happen to be metro, relatively medium-sized, even some larger suburban communities, but when we're dealing with our tours around the state and so on with capital requests, some of these are very small entities. And just how do they have access, and do you work with them? I just kind of walk me through just a quick synopsis of how that would work.
Sure. Madam Chair and Representative Carlson, the capital budget process in the spring of each year, MMB will issue capital budget instructions for agencies to submit requests for consideration. What will happen is a local unit of government currently would have submitted a capital budget request by filling out a form and submitting that via email to MMB to be included. This will transition the completion of the form to be actually in the system, so they would be entering the data associated with their capital budget correct directly in the system. The implications for local units of government are that if they still will have the ability to contact their local legislator and their local legislator to submit a bill for consideration on their behalf, the piece about collecting it in MMB's system is then it is also available. It's available comprehensively in July with all of the other requests that are submitted by state agencies as well as local units of government. And it's also then subject to consideration for inclusion in the governor's request.
Yeah, Representative, maybe I could do a follow-up. In our area, all of a sudden we've had a newly emerging issue, rerouting of rail trains, oil tankers. And nobody knew anything about that until about a month ago, when just by chance the city of Crystal, one of the cities I represent, was notified by a property owner that they were being asked to sell their property, and all of a sudden we're in discussions about some underpasses, for highway construction and so on for that rerouting. That just emerged in the last month. So how would they get plugged into the system? I've already, along with other area legislators, introduced legislation, but you know, the timeline you express and so on, how does that take place with the new system then? Mr. When the bill is introduced, then does somebody put it in, or
Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair and Representative Carlson, if they wanted to apply to be considered as part of the governor's budget request, we will be sending out information to all local units of government in the spring of this year about the process of applying. If they didn't submit an initial request for consideration, but later during the legislative session, a bill was introduced for consideration by a local legislator, that information will be tracked by the capital budget coordinator at MMB, and the capital budget coordinator would actually be entering that information into the system. And it would be not all of the detailed information that others who applied for consideration in the governor's budget, but more an identification of the purpose and the dollar amount being considered.
Okay, Representative, Madam Chair, it wouldn't be the burden on the city or another unit of government to do that at that point in time.
Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair and Representative Carlson, that's correct.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Representative Nelson, did you raise your hand? Yeah. Okay. Representative Earhart.
I'll wait till we get to page 5, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay. And Representative Rembeck, do you want to wait or do you want to proceed?
Just a real quick one then. In the capital budget system, is there an anticipation of a rating system? I mean, in terms of the need in different specifications or criteria that are being met? Any thought of rating them?
Ms. Weber?
Madam Chair and Representative Rembeck, individual entities that are applying, they do prioritize in the system. So they will identify if they have multiple requests, they will indicate the level of priority each of their individual requests have. The governor's decision-making process will not specifically rate them, but will indicate whether or not the governor is including the request in the governor's budget.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative?
Thank you.
All right. Ms. Weber, if you can proceed, please.
Madam Chair and members, on page 4, an overview of the Enterprise Learning Management System. This is the first system that I'll talk about today that is operating from the Oracle PeopleSoft system. That's another off-the-shelf product that supports many of our statewide systems. The purpose of this system is to support the registration process and availability of training course content for state employees. Currently, all state staff can register for training courses through the system. MNSCU is in the process of now implementing this system within their organization. And as I mentioned, this is a PeopleSoft technology. It's operating under version 9.1 of PeopleSoft. The cost to first develop this system was $1.1 million. The go-live for it was in July of 2014. We currently, in addition to MMB's Enterprise Learning and Development, which went live in July of 2014, there are 9 state agencies that are using this as a mechanism to advertise and register individuals for participating in the courses that they offer. And there are 6 state agencies in the process of now putting their course information into the system. We are hoping to upgrade the system over the next biennium to the most recent version of the software, but this one is particularly dependent on our funding request that's before you for consideration. The successes that we've achieved is that it's providing additional functionality. It also provides an enterprise-wide solution for course content, course availability, and registration. It will track an individual throughout their state service what courses they have taken, and it's increased our ability to provide reporting and information about the number of courses that are available, who's participated in the courses, and so forth. Some of our challenges have been that there are state agencies that provide courses and training to individuals who are not state employees. We refer to them as external learners. And so opening up the system to be available to external learners has been one of the challenges and one of the things that we haven't had resources to implement.
And Ms. Weber, that $1.1 million, did that come out of the operating budget for MMB, or was that part of the $4.?
Madam Chair, that was a combination of resources that were contributed by state agencies that were planning to utilize the system, as well as MMB operating funds.
Do you know how much the state agencies kicked in?
Madam Chair, I do have that information. I don't have it with me, but so I can provide that as a follow-up.
Great. Thank you. All right.
page 5, the fiscal note tracking system. This system just went live in January of this year. It also replaced a legacy system that had existed. The purpose of the fiscal note tracking system is to accommodate all of the various aspects associated with the fiscal note process. So that includes requesting a fiscal note. A fiscal analyst would go into the system and make a request for a fiscal note to be completed. MMB reviews the legislation and then assigns certain agencies to complete the fiscal note. Agencies then enter information in the system related to the costs or savings that may be associated with the proposed legislation. And then MMB, Budget Division, Executive Budget Officers review the fiscal note and release it for the legislature's consideration. It then ultimately is published to the MMB website for transparency purposes to be available to the public. This system supports 200 users to the system. It, as I had previously mentioned, was a custom build .NET development by Minute at MMB, and the cost that was allocated for this system was $1 million. As I mentioned, the system went live in January of this year. Currently, we are in the process of identifying any technical issues associated with the system and resolving those issues. So far, there have been 316 fiscal note requests, and this data is of early yesterday, so I'm sure it has changed, and 128 completed fiscal notes. One of the improvements is that we are collecting the narrative, background, descriptive information directly in the system, as well as the financial data associated with the legislation that's under consideration. We also have the ability for fiscal analysts to upload information directly into the system. Our old legacy system would not allow that, and we'd have to do that via email to collect any supplementary information, what we refer to as unofficial bill language. If a fiscal note is being requested on legislation that's under consideration but has not yet been introduced as a bill. We have also developed in the system the ability to have specialized security for unofficial notes that the author is asking be classified as private, so we have special security so that that's not broadly available for anyone to view. Some of our challenges have been around document accessibility. We have a fiscal note document that is accessible and is able to be recognized by someone who's using a screen reader, a JAWS reader. It does read all of the content associated with it. If an individual has a different disability and has different accommodations that are being made, we're working on resolving issues that we've seen with the document to make sure that that is fully accessible to those individuals as well. We've had some challenges associated with the correct emails going to the correct individuals. So as we've gone live with the system also has an ability to notify individuals of where a fiscal note is in the process, if a fiscal note's been requested, and things associated with that. And so we're resolving those issues as we've identified them. Companion notes are notes that are exactly, the language is exactly identical, and it's carried both in the House and the Senate. The notes should then just automatically match up to each other, so we've had some technical glitches that we've run into with respect to companion notes. And then the final challenge has been an intentional design feature that we've now, as we've implemented the system, noted that this is concerning, and that's the ability to modify certain fields. So, for example, if Ms. Roberts were to enter a fiscal note and she were to indicate the bill author for that fiscal note, another fiscal analyst could log into the system and they could change certain things that Ms. Roberts had entered. So we're working to resolve that as well.
Okay. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If this were a machine generated, it would be strictly nonpartisan. Can't make the machine lie, so would be replace the efforts underway to set up a new agency to monitor fiscal notes. Would it not?
Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair and Representative, the system collects the information, but it does rely on individual staff within agencies to enter background assumptions, what the formula is that they're using to identify either the costs or savings associated with it. So it is, the fiscal note document in and of itself is generated based on the input of that information that's put into the system.
Representative Earhart.
Well, Madam Chair, then this is evidence right here that we have to set up a new agency to take care of fiscal notes, right? I mean, if it's not going to do what we're trying to do, we're going to still have humans involved, and so that's going to skew things left and right and up and down.
Ms. Webber, I'm curious, you know, with the hiccups that have been experienced with the fiscal note tracking system and, you know, the challenges that that presents to us as a legislature, what is your time frame in addressing these hiccups, and when can we, when can we expect a process that works well for us? And then also, what kind of focus groups did you have for this piece of the technology upgrades?
Madam Chair, the fiscal note tracking system had a project team that comprised state agency staff as well as legislative fiscal analysts on the team. And that team was involved in establishing, both the requirements and how the system would be designed and function, as well as involved in testing the system functionality. Some of the items that have been discussed are related to the fiscal note process. And the fiscal note process is also overseen by Minnesota Management and Budget. And that is intended to be a nonpartisan process that is intended to convey information about the potential cost implications of a fiscal note. So what the system does, the system collects information, and in addition to overseeing the system, MMB oversees the policies and procedures associated with the fiscal note process.
Well, Madam Chair,
Representative Earhart.
Do I understand then that this is not going to take all of the partisanship, this machinery, the software is not going to take all of the partisanship out of a fiscal note, and they would still be in question depending on who was looking at the fiscal note?
Ms. Weber?
Madam Chair and Representative, the content of the fiscal note is always up to discussion between the legislature, MMB, and the agencies involved in producing the fiscal note. The Office of the Legislative Auditor conducted a review of the fiscal note process. I believe it was in 2012. And as a result of that review, they had recommendations and findings. And MMB worked in partnership with legislative fiscal analysts and state agencies to implement several improvements to the fiscal note policies and procedures, to also identify new functionality we'd like to see in the fiscal note tracking system to help in response to the findings. And we, on an annual basis, connect with fiscal analysts to discuss any issues that we may need to provide further clarification to ensure that the fiscal note is a review of the legislation and not a partisan document.
Representative Earhart?
Well, I'm just wondering if, in fact, Madam Chair, that this helps us or eliminates whichever side is crabbing about the fiscal note. Does this help to solve anything in any way? I mean, it still has human input into it, and so therefore we still feel justified in bitching about a fiscal note if we don't like it. Isn't that right?
Well, I think, Ms. Weber, it might be helpful for us to know what are the policies and guidelines that MMB gives to the agencies on putting together fiscal notes. And if that's something that you could share with Mr. Seidel, we'll make sure we distribute that to the committee as a whole, because I think that gets at maybe to the heart of the question that Representative Earhart is asking, too. And I think it certainly would be helpful for me to know, you know, what kind of guidance do you provide? And then if an agency isn't following up with the guidance, what kind of interaction do you have with that agency to make sure that we're all on the same page? I think that would be helpful.
Thank you.
The other question that I had, and we have some other members that have questions too, on the $1 million for the fiscal note tracking system, was that out of the MMB's operating budget then, or where did that come from?
Madam Chair, that came from the $4.5 million that was appropriated during the 2013 legislative session.
Okay. Great. And I have Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you just very briefly tell me what the origin of the fiscal note process is, when it began, and is this a considered a best practice among state legislatures, or is this unique with Minnesota? Just a little context.
Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair and Representative, I am drawing a blank on when the legislation was initially enacted. It is governed by legislation that indicates what will be included in the fiscal note. The state then has developed policies and procedures as well as the system. The 2012 Office of the Legislative Auditor report is an interesting read in that it also looked at what other states are doing, so it does have overviews of what various states are doing with respect to this as well.
I don't know if Mr. Shepherd or Ms. Roberts has an answer to that question of when we started the fiscal note before their time. Or Representative Johnson. Okay. All right, Ms. Weber, if you want to proceed.
Sure. Madam Chair and members, moving forward to page 6, which is an overview of the recruiting solution system. This is also a new technology system that's currently under development. MMB received an appropriation in 2013 from the legislature of $4 million to support the development of the system. It is replacing a legacy system, which is the system that collects applicant information when an individual is looking for employment within the state. So the system will publish information related to job openings, and it will allow individuals to apply for state employment. There will be 400 state agency recruiters, staff within human resource offices that will publish job openings into the system. It's available to all state employees to apply for jobs, as well as we receive on average 90,000 applicants per year that apply for state employment. The technology that this is being developed is also in PeopleSoft. So as I mentioned, the ELM system is developed in that as well as some of our others. And this one will be deployed in the most recently available version of the software. So we have two of our statewide systems that will be in the most recently available version. The timeline for this is we are currently testing the system, and our go-live is currently scheduled for the end of May. Some of the successes associated with it is that it will provide some additional functionality that our old legacy system did not have. It automates many of the hiring, the information associated with the hiring process. It also allowed for us to take a look at the hiring process overall. And it's more user-friendly than our existing system. Our existing system doesn't allow a user to directly input a resume, and when it outputs information for consideration by managers, it's in a very old technology format. So it's not as friendly as a resume format that an individual may have put together. The challenges associated with implementing the system have been associated, again, with accessibility, having the system be fully accessible for users and information that's provided from it. We've had software bugs that we've run into as we've been testing, and we did have released from Oracle what are called images, which provide fixes in some cases and additional functionality in others, and we did make a determination that the most recent image that was available would be important for us to install prior to going live with the system. Also, this is a new technology for us, and it's resulted in some business process changes.
And Ms. Weber, so the $4 million for this, where did this come from then?
Madam Chair, that was also appropriated by the legislature. So there were two appropriations to MMB, $4 million for the recruiting solutions and $4.5 million for the budget systems.
And is this something, in the old program that you used for this process, was that under your purview or was that under admin's purview?
Madam Chair, it was under Minnesota Management and Budget, and prior to the creation of Minnesota Management and Budget, DUER was a state agency that existed independently that utilized that system.
Got it. All right. Representative Rumbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just real quick then, you don't list it, but would Minsku be a part of this then?
Ms. Weber.
Minsku system?
Madam Chair and Representative Rumbeck, I'll have to check on that. I am not sure about that. If they'll also be posted. I believe they will be.
50,000 state employees, I presume that would be incorporate Minsku.
Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair and Representative Rumbeck, I believe that's true.
Okay, yep. Thanks.
All right, Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair and members, moving on to page 7, Semaphore, which is our current human resource system. So this system is used to manage, collect, and process human resource transactions, so once someone is hired to the state system, what classification they're in, et cetera. It also is used to collect payroll information and benefits information for state employees. We have 2,000 payroll, human resource, and management staff within agencies that are directly entering information into the system, and all state employees use this system for timesheet entry and their payroll processes. This is also developed in PeopleSoft, and we are currently in the process of going through a significant upgrade to the system to have it available in the most recent version, so it will be available in version 9.2. The cost for the upgrade is $2.7 million, and that is funded with MMB operating funds as well as statewide billing.
Ms. Weber, is when you say the users, are we assuming that there's some that aren't using this then?
Madam Chair, all state employees use it for the purpose of timesheet entry and their payroll processing. The users, the 2,000 payroll and human resource, those are within state agencies, the staff that work on human resource transactions who actually enter data into the system.
Go ahead, Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair, this system was implemented in July of 1995, and as I mentioned, it is right now going through the process of an upgrade, and we're scheduled to complete that by the end of April. Our successes associated with this are that it has provided increased functionality that supports the hiring process. Also, the integration of the Semaphore system with the recruiting solutions, the place in which individuals apply for jobs, and financial systems, our SWIFT system, so where people are actually paid from. The challenges associated with it are that federal and state laws are continually changing associated with hiring practices and benefit laws, etc. The complexity of images, what are called images, you may want to think of them as patches or fixes or increased functionalities. They are comprehensive packages that are released by Oracle that provide a lot of different things associated with it, and this is our first delve into images, a new industry practice, and so the complexity of installing them and identifying which aspects of the image we want to move forward with. Also, the complexity of what this system is providing when we look at the number of agencies using the system as well as the different union contracts and compensation plans that have to be accounted for in the system.
Okay. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And when you talk about upgrading this system, recent report in the news about the city of St. Paul, they upgraded their payroll system, and which led to the overpayment of employees. Are we checking to make sure that as we upgrade this, that we don't have quirks like that that happen in prior life? I had to deal with employees that for a local city school or a local school district that had inadvertently been paying their group of people, overpaying them for a period of time, and having to deal with getting those straightened out and paid back. So I know that's gets complicated if it goes on. So I'm just, are we checking to make sure that we don't have the same issue that City of St. Paul is currently having?
Madam Chair and Representative, we are currently in the process of testing those types of things as well as making sure individuals have the appropriate benefits associated with their positions and so forth.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair and members, moving on to page 8, the statewide integrated financial tools, this is the system known as SWIFT. It is the accounting and procurement system for the state that supports all of the state's financial transactions. We currently have 6,600 agency staff that directly enter information and transactions into the system. It was developed in the PeopleSoft financial management system, and this is operating under an old version 9.1. So this is directly related to the funding request included in the governor's budget. We are interested in upgrading to the most recent version of the software for SWIFT. The initial cost of implementation was $65 million. The system went live July 1st of 2011, and we're hoping to potentially do an upgrade in the next biennium, dependent on our funding request that's before you for consideration. It provides real-time processing of all transactions. It's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to state agencies. It also significantly expanded the functionality that our legacy system, which was known as MAPS, had. It has new modules, new functionality. It also made some processes that were done on paper more electronic, and it provides the ability to upload information directly into the system and has some workflow capacity that allows for review and approval of transactions. We were able to reduce the number of agency subsystems that existed and most recently implemented several reporting improvements with the ability to produce the CAFR directly from the source system in a more timely manner. It also has more granular security for individuals who are using the system to ensure they only have the ability to perform the functionality that their position supports. Challenges with the system very early on in implementation. Performance was a significant challenge. We did purchase some additional hardware that significantly improved the system performance. Also, reporting from the system, I'll talk later about our data warehouse and reporting, and due to the necessity to prioritize system functionality, reporting has been lagging with respect to the data that's in the system. And also keeping the technology current. As I mentioned, we're interested in upgrading to the most recent version, and there have been significant patches released in order to fix bugs that initially were included in the software.
And Ms. Weber, I apologize if I missed this, but the $65 million, was that part of your base budget or was that an appropriation?
Madam Chair, that was a creative financing strategy that I don't have enough context to adequately describe. I'm wondering if Ms. Roberts might know more about that.
Ms. Roberts.
Madam Chair, members, the SWIFT project was funded through a lease purchase arrangement, and we do continue to carry costs in the state government finance area for paying off the debt service on that agreement. But I can provide more information. It's been a couple of years, but I do have some background on that.
Perfect. Thank you. Okay. Any other questions, members? Ms. Weber?
Madam Chair and members, the final element of our statewide systems then is the data warehouse, the piece at which the data warehouse stores data that's collected in many of our statewide systems. The current users are individuals who are using and consuming data that's collected in our SWIFT system, as well as payroll information that's collected in our Semaphore system. We are working to make additional data available through the data warehouse that will include additional human resource information from Semaphore, as well as employment-based information from Recruiting Solutions. This is also developed in an Oracle technology. It's Enterprise Performance Manager, and the reporting tool that's used is called OBI. It's Oracle Business Intelligence Enterprise Edition. The costs for this, there weren't separate costs specifically allocated for the data warehouse. They are included in the statewide systems development. So in the development of SWIFT, in the development of Semaphore, resources have also supported the development of the data warehouse. Between 2012 and 2014, we released in the warehouse financial and payroll data. This current year, we have released additional information related to procurement. And in fiscal year 16, we are hoping to have available through the warehouse grants, contracts data, as well as additional human resource inventory data and employment data, which will all be sourced from SWIFT, Semaphore, and Recruiting Solutions. Big success associated with the data warehouse is the Transparency Min site that was released late last calendar year, and that provides a searchable database for financial information, budget information, as well as some vendor information. Also, the OBI reporting tool allows individuals to not just report data, but to create dashboards and things of that nature. some of our challenges associated with the warehouse, the platform or the EPM, Enterprise Performance Management software that the warehouse is developed in, is no longer supported by Oracle. They have moved in a different direction. Also, we have had to, the way in which we collect data in our systems and then the way in which we report it involves a highly customized transformation of the data between the source system and the warehouse. The reporting tool OBI allows you to do a lot of different things with the data on your computer screen, but the ability to print it out and disperse it for management reporting doesn't exist without a tool that's called Business Intelligence Publisher, and we have not yet installed that and been able to make that available to the agency, so that has been a challenge. And then finally, limited resources with both the development of standard reports for all state agencies to use as well as provide training on the reporting tool has been a challenge.
Okay. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess my question goes to the your first challenge that you list here, the system you're on is no longer supported by Oracle. Is this going to cause us at some point near term to have to shift to something else, which theoretically would cause a more cost, or have to buy a different program or redesign all these programs because Oracle is no longer supporting this?
Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair and Representative, the possibility of that does exist in the future, you know, for any of our statewide systems that we develop. In this specific instance, we did do an analysis of a more recent tool that Oracle had available and made a determination that we wanted to stay the course with the platform that we were developing our data warehouse in and to continue to do that and also develop the expertise internally to continue to support adding data to that system.
Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair and Ms. Weber, is this a chance? Is this, I look at this as maybe a challenge that we have when we buy stuff off the shelf and then the company we're buying it from switches. I mean, I've had some issues with this in my own programs that I have at home where you're using them and all of a sudden now they're no longer supported and they don't function with the latest and greatest rollout from Microsoft. Would this lead us to say it would be better for us to do it and design these systems in-house as opposed to buying something off the shelf? I mean, is that part of the debate that we have going forward on all these systems?
Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair and Representative, it's definitely a consideration we make when developing any new system. So as you'll see, we have a mix of our statewide systems, which systems are best suited with an off-the-shelf product to perform the most functionality, are consistent with industry practices. We've seen success in other states or other units of government. Which off-the-shelf products don't fully meet our business needs, so then do we need to develop a custom build? So it is part of the fit gap analysis when you're looking at what do we need the system to perform. These particular technology options are available to us. What is going to be the best fit for us overall?
Thank you.
Representative Earhart? No? Okay. Representative Nash?
Madam Chair, thank you. Ms. Weber, to follow up on the question of Representative Nelson, so the cost of an quote-unquote off-the-shelf, the development has been done by them and it's spread and or amortized across the number of instances that they sell it. Have you done the financial analysis of internal development versus off-the-shelf, and would you also comment, or my commentary, I guess, would be that just because something is no longer actively sold doesn't mean it is no longer actively supported. There are many pieces of software that have support long after they're being commercially offered, and if you would just corroborate that for me.
Ms. Weber?
Madam Chair and Representative, in terms of the financial analysis, we do have the analysis of what it's cost to develop each of these systems. So I have that available to you and have shared that today. In terms of an analysis of what will the cost be when we're moving forward with a new system, that is part of the process that we go through in terms of when we're looking at the different options of solutions for them. In the case of the data warehouse with the product no longer being offered publicly, I believe it's also no longer supported. And I'm looking to my... So it still is in support, but there is the future risk that it will not be supported in the future.
Representative Nash.
Madam Chair, yes, and I agree there is a risk, but they also have many, many users that are still on that system, and they understand that, and they continue to provide those support services. It may go on as long as 10 to 15 years. I've seen many software packages out in the field in my line of work where it's old, but it's still being supported. So I'm sure our phone of friends up there in the gallery can corroborate that.
Mrs. Weber.
Madam Chair, they are nodding affirmatively.
Thank you. For the record. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
And to this, I mean, the concern I have, and I guess having served on transportation in the Department of Vehicle Services and their systems and the length of time that they've been trying to get their new system up, and they have a system that's very old that is being held together with baling wire and duct tape, and they keep not extending the time of getting it up. That's the concern I have of these programs that it's in the computer systems are advancing quicker than we can sometimes keep up with it. That when we have a system that's not being supported that we're relying on, and all of a sudden it goes erp and doesn't work anymore or locks up, then we're going to be over the barrel to have to come up with a large amount of money to replace that system quickly. So I guess that's just a concern going forward with technology, and it's problematic.
All right. And you have the one last slide, Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair, and in conclusion, it's an appropriate transition, considering the comments from Representative Nelson, on the governor's budget request. So we are requesting $2 million in fiscal year 16 and $4 million beginning in fiscal year 17 and beyond to help with the support and ongoing maintenance and future development of these systems. We also don't yet know specifically what it will take to operate these systems on an ongoing basis and make sure they are available in the most recent version of the technology that exists, as well as we add additional data and information into these system performance associated implications with that. The purpose of our funding request before you is to perform upgrades specifically to the SWIFT system and the Enterprise Learning Management System. In addition to that, we know that we will have a need to replace system hardware in the relatively near future. And to be able to upgrade all of our systems to the more recent versions of the software, which oftentimes provide additional functionality that we've been asked to have available in our systems. If this funding is not received, we know that in the future we could incur increased annual support costs. The vendor has a practice of supporting certain versions of the software, and if you're operating on a older version, the support costs increase as a result of that. Also, the vulnerability to the stability of the system when you fall off of that support and no longer have the ability to rely on the vendor to provide fixes associated with your needs. Accessibility, as you saw throughout the course of my presentation, is a consistent challenge across all of our systems as we've worked in partnership with Oracle. Newer versions that they are releasing of the technology address some of the accessibility requirements that we have before us. And then also the resources both at MINUT and at MMB are currently dedicated to making sure these systems in their current state are available and functioning. So as we're performing upgrades, we need to bring in additional resources, or we need to assign resources at MINUT and MMB to work on the upgrades, and then need to make sure that our production systems that are currently in use are fully functioning for people. So this funding would provide us additional resources to be able to do that work associated with upgrades, as well as replace needed hardware. Further delay of the upgrades also will result in the farther and farther behind we fall, the more significant the level of effort is to upgrade to the most recent version.
Okay. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wondered... I mean, these are elaborate, complex systems, running an elaborate, complex, you know, set of agencies. Is there then within MMB, say, a vice president sort of level of human resources? Is there an individual sort of a vice president of finance and accounting that basically answers to anything? You know, where the buck stops on these? Could you give us some information on that? And maybe it would be helpful to see a reporting chart within MMB.
Ms. Weber.
Org chart.
Madam Chair and members, we can provide you an org chart. We have assistant commissioner positions that are the business owners of these various systems. So in the example of our Semaphore system and our SWIFT system, we have assistant commissioners that are over human resources and over accounting within MMB. I also am the enterprise resource planning director at MMB, so I do work across all of the statewide systems and provide leadership on the business side for all of the systems.
Madam Chair, it would be helpful to see an org chart. And, I mean, that's interesting. I think that we have assistant commissioners. I mean, my sense, having watched this for many years, is that the appointees of these large agencies don't normally get into the nitty-gritty nuts and bolts of running the agencies. I mean, that's just, you know, so anyway, I find that interesting, and seems like you'd want somebody more permanent to be really, really tracking and being very knowledgeable about how the whole thing works. But that's my comment. Thank you.
Okay. And Mr. Interwell, I know that you're not Ed McMahon of the group, so if you could please introduce yourself and provide the information that you have.
Madam Chair, thank you. Micah Intermill, acting statewide compensation manager at MMB, and I'm really resisting the urge to give a hi-yo. In light of the hour, I do have a handout prepared that's more background information on FTEs and different ways to slice the same data. I also have a list of about a dozen questions that were posed last time. So I guess if you would allow me a question of you, which would you prefer?
I think we might save you for later, if you don't mind, just to be able to get into that and give members an opportunity to speak to that. And I know that you guys are going to be back here at some point, too. So if you don't mind, we'll do that. Members, I did, too. Thank you both for coming today, and this was very helpful information. I appreciate it. Representative Johnson, you had asked about the timing of everything and getting through all of the details that we have. We've made significant progress in this committee in covering all the areas that are under our purview. We will continue to do that here in the coming month or so. I would ask that members, this is just a reminder, this is something that I had said to all of you when we first started state government finance. I provided you with the committee books in particular for a couple of reasons. One, I think it's helpful for members to have it in a tangible copy, if nothing else, to remind you that you need to read through these things. I'm not Representative Murphy. I'm not going to give you reading assignments or anything to that effect. But I do have expect, and I'm sure that you guys do this on your own, that you read through those materials. What's handy about the committee books that a lot of folks don't maybe realize is each agency gives a description of what their mission is and what they do as part of that committee book. So if you haven't had a chance yet to read through your committee book, I encourage you to do so. It's very helpful information. If you're not a person that likes the paper copy, all of this information is available on the internet. I will have Mr. Seidel here post a link to the governor's budget recommendations as part of our committee, also to make it available to the public, too, so they're aware of that. Also, I met with most of you, not all of you, prior to session starting, and asked what your priorities are, what you wanted to see to us do. We have been able to achieve a lot of those here in the committee hearings that we've had, and I appreciate the input. If you have other issues of concern, don't hesitate to either contact me. I would recommend that you contact Mr. Seidel as well, so that he can keep on top of me to make sure that we're covering those things too. When we get closer to committee deadline, just like any other committee, you should expect that you're going to have some committee hearings that are outside perhaps of our normal meeting time. So if you aren't planning for that, I would recommend that you start putting that into your schedule as something to expect for down the road. And with that, members, we are adjourned.
Madam Chair?
Representative Johnson.
So I'm just trying to figure out the game plan. Do you anticipate that we'll be looking at all the boards and committees and agencies that we have account purview over in this committee? I understand the importance of going through the book and so forth. That's a good idea, and I appreciate that. But do you think, are we also going to see these areas that we have accounts responsible for in this committee? Are we going to see them testify and have a chance as a committee to review that information?
Well, Representative Johnson, one of the things that I mentioned is we're not going to do the traditional overview that we have for every single agency. What I've asked you to do instead is to review your committee budget book and review that if you have questions about that. I have also asked that the agencies that have come to my office that they also visit with every member of this committee to go through those things. But at some point, we will be having conversations that are impacting those areas, and we'll have an opportunity if they're here to provide testimony to that effect and go over it in that realm. So if that gives you some idea of what to expect.
It does. I just want to make sure that we fulfill our responsibility as a committee to oversee and have the chance, because it helps to ask questions from both sides, I think, about what's going on within these different agencies and boards. And just individually looking at the books doesn't quite meet the need. We need to review it thoroughly and thoughtfully with people up there, and it looks like you agree, so I look forward to working with you on that.
We at some point will hear from everybody that's involved as we put together our budget. We don't have budget targets yet, but once we get those, that'll give us a better picture of what we are looking at going down the road. So with that, members, we are adjourned.